WHQR Public Media. This is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us for this special year-end edition. Well, 2025 has been a complicated year, especially in the early months when we spent a lot of time looking at the local impacts of significant policy changes put in place by the Trump administration. But there were also plenty of local stories that were bubbling up, not trickling down, and that included budget fights, concerns over housing and homelessness, and the ever-present issue of development, or, depending on who you ask, overdevelopment. Whatever you felt about the news cycle, and people had some feelings, believe me, it was never boring. In fact, a lot of the time it was damn near overwhelming. And that's why I'm grateful for my colleagues here at WHQR. Rachel Keith, Aaliyah McConnell, Kelly Knoyer, and Nikolai Mather. I couldn't ask for a better team, and I think they're the best ones to help unpack what this crazy year was all about. First up, my colleague, Rachel Keith. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And it has, once again, been a pretty wild year, and we can't recap everything, but there were a couple of stories we wanted to go back and just sort of think about in hindsight as we wrap up this year and look ahead to the next year. And a big one was definitely this school bond for New Hanover County.
That's right. So if the local government commission approves the ask, there will be a $320 million and a half school bond on the ballot in November. And what they have decided is a big contention point in this ask is that they finalized the projects that they want to fund with this $320 million. And only one phase is funded for New Hanover High School. And that is a pretty aging high school that we all know that has been more or less neglected and that they have not made the updates that they needed to. They've been doing some emergency updating, which is about like $10 million that they've had to put into the building so that it is safe for students. So technically, New Hanover High School, there's $170 million left to fund, and this bond would only fund $60 million. And then we have a Republican Commissioner, Dane Scalise. He has now said that he is running for Ted Davis's seat next year, but then he talked about why there's only going to be phase one that's going to be funded, and it is unfortunate.
I'll just offer that the difference is that 20, 25 years ago, there was a need study that was performed, and no one took any action.
That's correct.
They did nothing.
Yeah.
The people that are sitting here today are taking action. And I think that that is a testament to our collective desire to address this issue among many others in our community. And you've got to start somewhere.
Right.
And I hope that what we are doing is demonstrating for the present and the future the correct course of action, and that we are leading by example for those people who will come after us.
So you can hear Democratic Commissioner Stephanie Walker agreeing with him. So the school board and the commission are all on board with this ask. But yes, I mean, it is an open question. They're going to fund this first phase, but who is going to fund this 2 through 4 phases? And again, yeah, who's picking up that? They've mentioned the endowment as a possibility. Maybe future budgets will be able to allocate that funding, but we're not sure.
You know, there's been some conversation about the way they set up this multi-phase approach so that if, you know, at the end of each phase, it's sort of a complete segment, so you don't have students stranded, basically. But I think there's a fair amount of legitimate concern because we can't see into the future. We don't know who will be sitting on future boards and what future economic circumstances will look like. And so I think it's a legitimate concern that, you know, down the line, there just isn't the political will to finish this, you know, long deferred and long overdue work on New Hanover High School.
But both boards, you know, said, we're hoping we're setting a precedent and that everybody else will come along and continue to support this. And they couldn't fund the whole big everything for New Hanover because they're doing a redo of Trass Middle School that will be on CTEC's campus, building River Lights Elementary, Pine Valley Elementary, and Porter's Neck Elementary will be getting some new buildings as well. And then they're also, it's millions of dollars for new technology and other types of HVAC updates. So there's only so much funding that they had to spread around.
Right. And this is $320 million. And that covers ballpark half of what they really needed. you know, we've been told this has effectively exhausted the county's ability to take on debt. So this is going to have to hold them for a while.
Yeah, that's what Chris Coudray, the county manager, said.
So you mentioned the endowment. we can't ignore that. That's always the elephant in the room.
Yes.
When talking about funding issues, for sure. So let's talk about the reporting you did on kind of an interesting and almost unique window into the relationship between the endowment and New Hanover County Schools, because often when the endowment is dealing with folks, the endowment is private, nonprofits are private, so it's not like we can request emails. But in this case, you got a window into what was going on.
Yeah, it took me a long time to get these emails from the district, and they were conversations back and forth between the endowment staff and the school district. And I followed this all year because it started out with Superintendent Dr. Christopher Barnes asking for about $8 million for 42 specialists to put in the school, because the schools, they say constantly, I'm at a lot of these meetings with these principals and teachers, and they're saying, we need more people, we need more people, we need more staff. There's not enough staff to do all the things that we need to do. So that's why Dr. Barnes asked for that. The county said no. So then they started to ask the endowment, and what they put in for their application was $8 million to cover those 42 specialists. And what they ended up getting was 14 specialists. We still do not know where those people are going and how they're being allocated amongst the schools for $2.7 million. So that's what it ended up as.
Right. And there was obviously the question here was, how did they go in asking for eight and come out only getting $3 million?
That's correct. And I put this to the endowment's education leader. His name is David Stiegel. And he said, this is what he said about the ask. And I'll talk about, you know, how this got whittled down, which he, you know, took issue with.
Because we didn't think they could use them or would use them wisely. It's we have the capabilities to do 14, see what works with that and get data from that to inform next year's cycle. And as in subsequent years, they'll be, I feel quite confident there'll be more grant requests.
So he was saying that there wasn't enough money to do this full ask. But in these emails, I figured out there were a couple of potential culprits for them saying no. We could see that David was, Stiegel was saying that the Dibble scores, it's a proficiency reading score for kindergarten through second grade, I believe. And he was saying that those scores were not high enough for the board, for the endowment board. And they were also saying, you know, we put in $8.7 million for that early learning facilitator grant. That was one in each elementary school. And they were saying they weren't necessarily seeing the results of that quite yet. So even though they said that, of course, the schools could use more, but they only had so much funding left. But you could also see him talking about that there were these other concerns with the impact of the early learning facilitators and on the Dibble scores. And what's interesting, the Dibble scores were pretty good, but the third grade proficiency end of reading scores were not as high as I think the district wanted, and they're not, you know, where they need them to be. And I had to go on a hunt between what's the difference between Dibbles and the EOGs. And EOGs are the more end of grade tests are more of the summative. And this is like basic skill assessments is the Dibbles score. And again, the endowment did take issue with it got whittled down. It's just we could only do what we could do. But the fact is they asked for the 42 people and they only got enough money for 14 people.
Yeah, I mean, right now, to be fair, the endowment is limited by its own bylaws, but certainly they are prioritizing grants all the time. And I think it is fair to say that, you know, the performance of that reading grant played into the process of prioritizing grants. I don't know if you can get away from that.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty clear in the emails, and it was just odd that there was this disconnect between what was in the emails and then what he was telling me in an interview.
So I think that we have been looking to the endowment for all kinds of things, and that certainly was the case after New Hanover County's pretty tense budget negotiations. There was sort of a last-minute day of agenda meeting debate over some of the granular details of the budget, but we saw nurses and a pre-K cut, and And that caused like a lot of public pushback.
Yes. So what was cut out of the New Hanover County budget was $1.6 million for 14 nurses. So I did a story that showed that over half, about 60% of the schools had to share a nurse when they were used to having one of their own. And the county spokespeople at the time were saying that we're going back to the state recommended level. But then parents in the community were really used to having their dedicated nurse. And, you know, a lot of students have conditions that they need help support with during the school day, like if a student has seizures or type 1 diabetes, that nurse is really instrumental in creating a safe place in that school. So they also did have to cut 6 preschool classrooms. There used to be 12. And, you know, they were saying that this is what our budget's going to be. And I started talking, once I figured out where they were going to share the nurses, I put out an article telling the community where they were going to go. And people didn't know until much later that they were going to lose one of their nurses. And I talked to a parent at Gregory Elementary School. Her name is Wendy Principe, and she was talking about losing her child's nurse, which was very upsetting to her. And she was saying, I asked her, hey, what's the vibe are you when you're talking to the staff? What do they feel like, you know, that they feel like they have to travel to different schools or their schedules are not as consistent as, you know, they were used to?
I think they're nervous. I don't think anybody feels like this is a fine plan, okay? I think that they are bound by what has happened, right? Like, they don't have the power to change it.
And I thought that was very interesting impression that they don't have the power to change it, but the community put enough pressure on the county commission to put those nurses back in, and they did it. They reversed that funding and put them back in the schools. And I checked with the county, and it came from the Mental Health and Substance Use Disorder Fund. So they found the money to put those nurses back in. And as of December 17th, they have 4 vacant nursing positions and 1 supervisor position. And so technically only 8 schools are sharing. So it's going to take some time. But I mean, I talked to a lot of parents. This other story I did, I mean, they were going to go to the county commission meeting. They were starting a petition. Commissioners Rob Zappel and Stephanie Walker were pressuring, you know, the other 3 Republicans to take a look at this again. There was some reluctance, but I think the public pushback really changed the calculus for the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners.
I think so, and I think this was an issue that was really bipartisan. I mean, we heard from conservative parents, liberal parents. It didn't seem to matter. I mean, it's your kid, and they wanted the certainty of knowing there was going to be a nurse in there. I mean, I don't want to go back and relitigate the whole thing, but you know, a lot of this seemed to stem from just how quickly that last-minute budget got hammered through, and it seemed like some of the commissioners weren't even 100% sure what they had cut, just that they had, you know, reached a certain tax rate. But certainly, the public pushback was immediate, and it was, in this case, quite effective. So before we go, I do want to touch on something. I feel like we talk about this every year, and that is restrictions and bans on books.
Yes. So there are new restrictions on the book Blended for elementary students, and the school board made a decision on stamped anti-racism, racism in you, that it indefinitely, as of now, cannot be taught in the classroom. Yes, they can access the library book. Yes, you can access Blended, but then you do have to check it out with permission from your parents. So we still had, and actually with Blended and Stamped, you have full school committees of educators saying, put the books back, no stipulations around these books. But eventually they were just overruled by the board and the superintendent.
And the last thing I want to touch on here is that I feel like every year a new board chair is elected on the school board and other boards. There's often this kumbaya moment where everyone talks about, you know, going into the new year, the spirit of, you know, collaboration and transparency. But it's hard to ignore. This was kind of a rough year. There was some serious strife on the board.
Yes. I mean, I had to cover the censure hearing for Democratic member Tim Merrick. I had to cover the potential censure of Republican David Perry. And then there were censure motion brought forth potentially by Judy Justice, who's a Democratic member, and Tim Merrick about how Josie Barnhart talked to a parent of a student about the sex education curriculum. So it was a pretty tumultuous year. It's going to be interesting in the fall when we're going to approach. There are 4 open seats for the school board next year. And so are they going to say, I'm going to put a stop to this drama and I'm going to work together? I mean, these members did the same.
Well, before I let you go for the end of this year, anything else you want to touch on or anything you're looking forward to within reason for next year?
I'm looking to see if this school bond is going to pass. It's going to be a big year for the school board. It could change the majority on the board this year. You know, there wasn't a way to really change the majority last time. And then the strategic plan update, they do this every 4 or 5 years. I mean, they have committed this board to eliminating the equity pillar that used to be in there. So that's going to be going away. So, I mean, it's a big year, a big political year for the school board, and I'm looking forward to covering it.
All right. Well, Rachel Keith, thank you so much for being here, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment with more of our year in review with Aaliyah McConnell and Kelly Kinoyer. I'm Ben Shockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us for our special year-end edition. With me now is my colleague, Aaliyah McConnell. Aaliyah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So you were pretty busy this year, and a lot of that was community engagement. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And I want to start with the Northside Voices. Can you reflect a little bit on that?
Yeah, so that was a community listening session that we were kind of asked to do through NC Local. They gave us a stipend to put together these listening sessions to get a better gauge of what people think that they would want to see more reporting on. And I kind of tackled a community that we hear from time to time, but I don't think we really focus on too much. And since, you know, you have the Northside Food Co-op that has been trying to fulfill the needs of a grocery store in the North Side, and a lot of things that you hear about gentrification happening in that area, I thought that it would be a great place to start and to focus on. So yeah, I held that at the Sportsman, and people were like, you're doing a North Side event on the South Side. That's smart. But people look like, you know, you actually got people to come out and like branch out of their neighborhoods and commune with each other, maybe in a different area. But the sentiment is still there of, you know, people coming together. I think that was a really great experience. And I took away a lot from that. People had a lot to say. And that within itself, you know, just lending a, you know, listening ear to people was really a great experience.
Yeah. And the Sportsman is a legend.
It is.
So another thing, I wonder if you can talk a little about this. This was another NC Local or an NC News project. And this was an info summit. And this is a little inside baseball, but I think it's interesting. The title was What Journalism Schools Didn't Teach You. And we get questions from folks all the time who want to know how this stuff works, like how the next generation of journalists are being trained and what maybe they're not being trained on. So tell me a little bit about that.
So on one hand, I was really flattered to be asked that. And then on another hand, I was like, do I really sound this naive out here in this world? And so the answer is kind of both. What I kind of focused on was the experience of moving from like a bigger city and having to adjust to a smaller community. That's a little bit more, you know, you have your pockets of people who are more tight-knit, and in a city, you know, it's faster pace and people have probably spoken to reporters before. You're more likely to encounter people who have dealt with reporters, so they kind of know what to say and they're a little bit more forthcoming and available because they're kind of like, yeah, here's my message. I wanted to tell you this and get it out and we'll get it done.
Right.
And that's very much the pacing of it. But here, it's kind of like you have to really take your time and build relationships with people. You have to be seen, and there's a a huge element of trust building that is associated that, you know, honestly, I feel like I'm still in the process of learning. Yeah, that's pretty much what I kind of focused on, but it was just a, it was a good experience. I'm glad they asked me, but I'm just like, ah.
Wait, is this a backhanded, it's all, what's happening here?
Right. I don't know. I just, when we had our RFA, North Carolina RFA core member meetup, I guess I just had a lot of questions that, you know, maybe a more seasoned reporter probably would already have under their belt. And so I, you know, may have been tipped off that there's just some things that maybe, the fact is that journalism programs vary from university to university. And so, you know, some programs may not be as developed or renowned for the classes or professors that they have or whatever. But, you know, knock to knock, my school, Kennesaw State University, there's just certain things and certain experiences that I didn't really get to touch too much on just because of what was offered. Also, coming out of the pandemic, a lot of things were different coming out of that phase. So certain things weren't as hands-on as I would have liked them to be just because of that whole transition period of things coming back on. And with my bachelor's in journalism, that there would still be a lot that I had to learn. You know, there was still a lot of real-world experience that I would need to have under my belt.
Sure. And you, I think you got a lot of experience when you did your roundtable on homelessness. That was both a pretty significant logistical challenge, like getting it all set up, and then, you know, it kind of straddled the lines between community engagement and reporting. So tell me, walk me through a little bit about, like, how that got, that came together.
So it came together. Honestly, the idea just sparked in my mind when I was hearing the debates going on at City Council. I think it was like the first meeting where, you know, people kind of showed up because City Council member, or former City Council member Luke Waddell, he was kind of sounding off online about public safety matters and introducing that ordinance and maybe like a youth curfew and stuff like that. So a lot of people came out to hear what he had to say. It wasn't his first time bringing it up to the council. I was there listening to everything that was going on and all the back and forth and what the business owners had to say. And I was like, why can't we all just get in one room? And, you know, I'm sure we can't sort it all out in one conversation, but let's just kind of find some middle ground. My idea was to try to get as many different voices as I could to sit at the round table and kind of see how homelessness impacts like their sector of their work or their experience. And from that, what solutions they kind of glean from their understanding of what homelessness is or what it's like to be homeless. So that was kind of the whole idea of it. And yeah, it ended up coming together. It took like 3 hours. It was a long conversation because there was a lot of people there.
Yeah.
You know, I had to really take my time with it and put it together. But I think that I accomplished what I had set out for, which was to just bring people together and have those different opinions offered and so people can hear them out.
So before I let you go, I want to talk about some of the other reporting you've done over the last year that you told me you were proud of. Really deep dive that you did was on what's called 287G. This is the legal relationship between local law enforcement and federal immigration enforcement. Tell me a little bit about that.
So the 287G program, I started doing that story probably in February. So this was, you know, not too long after the results of the presidential election. And of course, people were already kind of on alert about the increase in immigration enforcement. You know, I kind of just wanted to dive headfirst into that and really address those concerns because kind of was like a signal that things were going to change for a lot of people very soon. And, you know, I would go to Know Your Rights trainings. I would go to CAMBR NC's ICE verification trainings. And from those meetings, just hearing and talking to people, I really understood like the weight of this and what it means for people now. So I wanted to do something to kind of take a look at where North Carolina is as a state on immigration and how many programs that are currently in existence now. And it kind of serves as a benchmark of how much has happened since the beginning of the year. Like there's, I think, over 1,000 287G agreements now, when there used to be maybe, you know, being generous, I want to say about, it was in the hundreds, a very stark increase. Wanted to talk about the 287G program, what it is, how people, how law enforcement agencies can participate in that, why they would participate in it, what's in it for them, like what if ICE comes to them and offers them this kind of contract, what those incentives are that make them even want to participate in that. And then I also talked about just the power of the sheriff's office and how that has kind of led to this battle of the constitutional view of enforcing the law versus, you know, just enforcing the law. There are people who, some sheriffs who kind of claim that the Constitution gives them more rights, a foundational right to enforce the law how they see fit, as long as, you know, hey, this is the law and I'm trying to follow it. But it doesn't really allow for, you know, more nuanced understanding of things, especially things like immigration. It was a lot. So it talked about how sheriffs, the relationship between sheriff's agencies and the 287G program, you know, the different models that are within the 287G program. There's like three different models that agencies can operate under, and some are a little bit more kind of abrasive than others. Mm. But yeah, I really, I enjoyed doing that piece. I even spoke with the executive director for the National Sheriffs Association. And that was actually when I went to D.C. to the NPR headquarters for our criminal justice fly-in. And he was one of the guest speakers there. And of course, in a room full of reporters,
right,
this man was like inundated with questions about immigration right there on the spot. And it was kind of, you know, it's kind of cool because I got to look at him in the eye and like face to face and like ask him these questions. I went all the way to D.C. to do this story.
There you go.
So, yeah.
I know that you've had a number of other stories that you put a lot of time and energy into. Don't have a ton of time left here, but I want to touch really quickly on the midnight basketball story, because I know that's like a very different view of law enforcement that I don't think we see as much of that.
Yeah. And I don't know how familiar the public is about that.
Well, give them a quick description of what we're talking about here.
Program. But yeah, so the Midnight Basketball Program is a part of Wilmington Police Department's Police Athletic League initiative. So it's a program that operates within that effort that they do. But pretty much it's Deputy Chief Kelvin Hargrove who runs the program, and a bunch of other officers kind of volunteer and help out. It's every other weekend, I believe, but it's Friday and Saturday, and it starts at 7 o'clock, and it's at the MLK Center. So a bunch of teens and, you know, youth from the community, they go there, they play basketball with the officers, and it's really seeing your family just hanging out, you know. They feed them, they'll have guest speakers come and mentor them, you know, and it's just giving a lot of those teens and youth that may not have both parents in the home or a really, you know, structured foundation, it gives them the opportunity to engage with positive adults who can help mentor them and kind of guide them through life. On the flip side of that, it does give them a positive encounter with law enforcement, kind of with the hopes of maybe they build a relationship. And even if they don't necessarily go into law enforcement, at least they know that face within the department. You know, they can say, I know Deputy Chief Hargrove. And
a lot of those kids do, and they come back to see them.
They come back to see him. They go off to college, or they come back in their 30s sometimes, you know, with families, and they come to and say, what's up?
Well, before I let you go, anything else you want to shout out from this year, or anything else next year you're looking forward to?
I look forward to doing more stories that are like community and cultural focused. But yeah, and other than that, I'm going to go out with a bang.
All right. Well, Aaliyah McConnell, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
All right. Up next is my colleague, Kelly Knoyer. Kelly, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So longtime listeners will notice that I sound a little different. It's because I'm recording from home, because Kelly sent me home, which is a large part of her job.
Yeah, surprisingly large part of my job. Also, you know, right before the holidays, no one really wants to get sick. So you keep your germs at home, Ben. Thank you.
Fair enough. All right. Well, on with the recap. So you, as with every year, you cover a wide range of stuff, but you've really dug down on homelessness and housing this year a lot. And one of these stories was a little less of a traditional story. It was almost about another, it is about another media outlet. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so this was a story about the Homeless Herald. And I mean, just a note on housing, this year has been pretty rough to witness. There's been a lot of losses of funding across the county, the state, and the federal level. And so it's been kind of a painful beat in the past year or so. You can talk to advocates. There's only a couple very small bright spots compared to a lot of darkness in terms of housing funding, helping people who are unhoused. So this was a story that was surprisingly nice and happy and cheerful in some respect, because it was a lot more about unhoused individuals taking ownership of their lives, because there's this new news outlet, as you said, called the Homeless Herald, and it's by and for unhoused individuals in the Cape Fear region. It's also for people who aren't unhoused, so we can all understand their perspective a little bit better.
Yeah, I think their part of their banner is nothing about us without us.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that was really interesting on reporting this story for me was being able to sit in on one of their editorial meetings, and it felt a lot like being in any newsroom and listening to any editorial meeting. There was a discussion about what happened at a recent council meeting, interpretations of what that meant for them as people, and also what it meant for the community. And it sounded a lot like the kind of banter and discussion that we would have at WHQR.
Yeah, I mean, that was something I was skeptical about, not because of anything to do with their housing situation, just because I have seen a lot of new media outlets come and go, and it is a lot harder than it sounds. But from your reporting, it sounds like they were pros. They were in the trenches getting the work done.
Yeah, and I have to say, talking to Pastor Meg McBride, who's the editor of the Herald, and also the person who's running the day center and the warming shelter here in the Cape Fear region, she says that this is a really meaningful thing for folks in their lives, because when you're unhoused, it's really hard to feel like there's meaning in what you do day to day. There's so much sitting around waiting and having nothing to do other than hope somebody is going to help you out. And so being able to take some control and move forward in their lives in their own way has been really meaningful for a lot of the folks who are working on the Homeless Herald.
So you mentioned it. I don't think anyone will have missed it this year. There was a lot of funding cuts across the board, really, from the federal, state, and local level. And that has put a lot of existing plans on hold. There was one kind of bright spot here in the funding verse, and that is the potential for passenger rail.
Oh, yes. This was kind of an interesting story for me. And I just, full disclosure, I originally pitched this to Assembly and then the Assembly, and then I was able to do a version of it for the newsroom, which I always had planned to do because I love audio and it's my favorite medium. But this was so interesting because we got funding to study passenger rail in North Carolina a few years ago under the Biden administration. It was money from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. And everybody kind of was sitting and waiting at the start of the Trump administration. All of these different grants were getting canceled. Everyone was sort of waiting around to see, is this going to cut passenger rail too? And it turns out, no, this thing is moving forward. It's trudging along. And it's just a question of whether or not these routes are going to get built or not. So I did kind of a story exploring what it would look like to have passenger rail, and also looking into the history of passenger rail in the state of North Carolina. I mean, we were once home in Wilmington to the longest railroad in the world, and then it shut down in the middle of the last century. So we've had this history. There's a lot of evidence of the railroad that used to exist here in Wilmington, and it could come back, which I think a lot of folks are really excited about, both for economic reasons and selfishly for the reason of I want to go to Raleigh and not drive.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there really are two stories intertwined here. One about just how profoundly rail shaped Wilmington and then sort of left the city bereft when it left. But also, you know, we're supposed to be objective journalists. We look at policy. We try to explain how it works. But it's hard not to be like a little bit romantic about the idea of hopping on a train and going to Asheville, you know, beyond Raleigh, you know, coast to mountains. I mean, that would really be something.
Yeah, I mean, I know that we're supposed to be unbiased, but I don't think I was really able to hide my excitement in this newsroom episode because I really think trains are cool. And I had so much fun at the Railroad Museum that's here in Wilmington. And you can hear my excitement talking to folks in some of these interviews. So if you want to hear me be extremely impassioned about trains, you should listen to this episode.
Radically pro-train. But I will say, you know, we heard there's been a lot of bipartisan support for this. So this didn't really feel like a partisan issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were looking for opposition. I was actively trying to find opponents and couldn't really find any. I think that for a lot of folks, it's something that sounds like it would be nice, and it may not be the top of the priority list. So I think there's an ongoing question of funding in the long term for this to happen, but I think there is a lot of positive feeling toward this idea.
All right, so moving on, you were a pretty consistent stringer for NPR this year. You've done NPR stories in the past, but this year, you were on like on speed dial for them.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to pitch them on a lot of things that I thought they might enjoy, which tends to be weird science-y stories and really funny things. So it's been a good time. Most recently, I did the turkey fry, which was where the fire department in New Hanover County failed to explode a turkey. That one was charming. I also did the pooch plunge in September, which was just dogs jumping into the pool at Legion Stadium. And I have to say my favorite thing about reporting for NPR is that I send them audio, but then they piece it together. I work with the editor there. I talk to them about the script. We kind of figure out what sound bites we want to put where. But then you send it off to the producers. And the more material you give them, the more creative they are. So I want to show you this little section from the turkey fry. This was not put in my script.
For this demo, the frozen turkey got the bomb treatment. Dunked in the oil from the end of a long pole, with observers standing 40 feet away.
Oh, yeah.
Rube Goldberg, the release mechanism, you know?
Just drops in.
Yeah.
It created a bit of a flare-up around the pot, and the oil spat everywhere, but no real explosion, to Melvin's disappointment.
That Rube Goldberg line, not in my script.
But it's a great line.
Yeah, it's so funny, and they do this with all kinds of things, like here's the pooch plunge. Across the pool is Floki, the smallest dog here, a little white West Highland Terrier who is soaked. His owner, Tracy Clary, says he has a typical Westie personality.
Very confident. He's a big dog in a little body.
But they're not natural swimmers.
He accidentally went in and was going after the ball and he couldn't stop in time, so.
Clary brought Floki here to join her son and his Labrador, who is happily leaping into the pool, no hesitation. I didn't put in that little splash of that dog falling in the water. They did. And I think that it sounds so much better. Also, I did a story about invasive algae. This researcher found out all of this interesting information about how algae is impacting the mercury cycle here in the Cape Fear region and all along the East Coast. And I just think it's really amusing that NPR will always go for the funniest bit. So here's them putting myself falling around in mud under my own voiceover.
Scientists are studying an invasive species of algae they believe can cause an increase in mercury levels in the food chain. From member station WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina, Kelly Knoyer explains.
For tourists, coastal North Carolina is a paradise. And that's the case for tiny little eastern mud snails, too. But instead of white sandy beaches, these tiny gastropods love the brackish water and muck of the estuaries.
NPR loves a self-depreciating journalist.
And I am happy to be that for them. NPR, come after me. I love it.
That's right. Okay, but we can't forget maybe the wildest story, I think, and that was feral hogs.
Oh, yeah. Feral hogs was, that was some serious reporting. I know when I talked to people about it, they were like, that's a silly story, but it's actually a lot of economic devastation for folks in this community. And I had audio of these pigs just smashing themselves against some of the fences where they were getting caught in these traps. When that door falls, the entire sounder, that's what a family group of pigs is called, starts sprinting around the corral. Biologists say trapping is the most effective way to take out feral hogs. You can kill the entire group in one go. Honestly, this was one of my favorite stories this year because it was really challenging to report. Going out into rural areas, there's a lot of folks who really don't trust journalists, and I had to do a lot of work to build any trust with some of the farmers I talked to. But I think that they felt pretty happy with how the story came out, like they were being represented accurately, and that's what I want for all of my sources.
Yeah. I mean, certainly it can feel like we're parachuting in, but I think if you give us a chance, we will do you solid.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, obviously there was a lot of housing stuff going on this year. Changes with the city, changes with the county. We don't have time to go through everything, but give us a little bit of a rundown of, you know, the kind of blizzard of housing news that we dealt with.
Earlier this year, we saw around budget season, New Hanover County pulled out of the Workforce Housing Advisory Committee, and they also pulled some of the funding that they were giving to nonprofits. So there was this retraction by the county from some homeless services, and that was really impactful for how the city then was planning to move forward. It seems like the city wants to reinvest in housing and in homelessness a little bit more, but that came on top of them passing this homelessness ordinance that was very unpopular with a lot of constituents. I think it got softened a lot by Democrat David Joyner, who was on the council, but Republican Luke Waddell, who's no longer on council, really was spearheading this. And a lot of people opposed it because they thought of it as criminalizing homelessness. I do think the fact of that ordinance coming up, it led to a lot of advocacy around homelessness from the greater community. And I think it kind of pushed elected officials at the city to promise to invest more in homeless services. They said that they would bring a new shelter to Wilmington. And I will tell you, that is badly needed. I mean, every kind of shelter, every kind of person who could need shelter right now, there's a wait list. Good Shepherd Center has a wait list. We see that at every shelter in town. And so the need is extreme there. I do think in other respects, we've seen that there's a retraction by the federal government as well. There's also a retraction in funding from the state level. So across the board, a lot of housing and homelessness related service providers are strapped. And I think that there's a lot of worry about what next year will bring. Some of the grants that people typically have relied on are now in court, and there's a lot of fighting happening in terms of what that funding is going to be. I'll be bringing new stories about this in early 2026, but what I'll say is it's a pretty dark picture at the moment. In terms of positive news, we did see the finished construction of Starway, which is a new low-income housing project. That was really beneficial. I think the rents are a little higher than some of us had hoped just because the area median income has gone up. That's been tough, but we also are seeing new plans for development at 3939 Market Street. That should be really helpful. And WHA is in the process of redeveloping some of its properties. We're going to see Hillcrest start its first phase probably in 2026. That is dependent on HUD and the federal government continuing with some of the things that they've historically always done. And I think that a lot of us are wondering whether that's going to happen. But currently, it looks good. And so we're going to just hope that that stays the case and bank on that going into 2026.
I think for now, we've earned it looks good for now.
Yes. I think we're at that point right now, and we're all going to just hang on, you know?
I think so. All right. Well, Kelly Knoyer, thank you very much for being here, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up our year-end review with my colleague Nikolai Mather. I'm Ben Shockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us as we round out our special year-end edition. With me now is my colleague, Nikolai Mather. Nikolai, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, you've had a pretty wide-ranging year this year. Where would you like to start?
I think I'll probably start with the harder stories and work my way up to, like, the happy, fun ones. The most challenging story I had to follow this year was the shooting in Southport. It was a Saturday night in September. I think I was actually watching The Seventh Seal when I saw your text in the group chat. I've covered mass shootings before, but something about the scale of destruction and, like, the fact that it was in Southport of all places, I literally could not believe it was happening for a few minutes. But then you put your head down and you get to work. And we did that at the newsroom. I did a write-up on the website that night, and then I went down to Southport to cover it for national news and for local. You did that long read about your conversation with the shooter, Nigel Edge, which still keeps me up at night, frankly. We also did a deep dive on Edge. We looked into his past legal entanglements. We talked to his neighbors. We both read his autobiography / manifesto.
Yeah, that book was not easy to read.
Oh, absolutely not. No. But yeah, the update on that story is not extraordinarily exciting at this time. I'm still trying to work out a public records request with a couple of different local and state agencies. I'm hoping that once I get those records, if I get those records, cross your fingers, we can shed some more light on the kind of person Edge was and what his interactions with law enforcement prior to the shooting were like.
Yeah, I know there's still a lot of interest in that story. Unfortunately, sometimes the gears of the criminal justice system move kind of slowly.
Absolutely.
So for folks who are waiting for the latest news on the criminal aspect of that, you've just got to be patient, unfortunately. But yeah, that's the latest on that. Another tough story you kept an eye on was the death of Pender County school teacher Heather Fennell. She was a beloved member of that community, and it's been just over a year since she passed away. Do you have anything to update us with?
I mean, gosh, talk about, like, the gears of the criminal justice system. This is a really hard one. I get listener emails about Heather Fennell, like, on a weekly basis. People want to know what happened and whether the State Bureau of Investigation has made any progress on their investigation into her death. I did report on the autopsy. That was released on June 11th, and it included some pretty distressing details, including the fact that Fennell died by a gunshot wound to the head. Authorities have still kept pretty mum about whether this was a suicide or if it was a homicide. It seems like those details are still pending per the autopsy. Fennell's boyfriend, Scott Lawson, who was apparently living with her at the time, is a former sheriff's deputy, which appears to be the reason why SBI stepped in to take over the investigation in the first place.
Yeah, he actually ran for sheriff at one point, right?
He did run for sheriff, yes.
So are there any updates there?
So I've been in pretty constant contact with the SBI press team since Heather Fennell passed away, and they have not been able to offer any further details since June. According to spokesperson Chad Flowers, SBI is still waiting on several lab reports to come back from the state crime lab. Once those are sent over, he says they'll send the case to the district attorney. I asked for an ETA on that, but he wasn't able to share more. He did say it was taking an unusually long time to process, but that could be for any reason whatsoever. Just a side note, too, me and Ben have talked about this, but we did just want to say shout out to Chad Flowers, because not every press officer can or will respond to your texts and inquiries, like, right away in real time. But Chad Flowers has always been, like, on the money with us. He's always been upfront with us about what he can share, and he's always been he's responded pretty quickly. So I appreciate that.
And he's got a background in journalism.
He is a former journalist, and he now works for the SBI. He's been very instrumental in trying to get information out about this. But again, it's not always within his control. Right now, it appears to be with the state crime lab, and he doesn't have control over that. I really wish I had more to share, because I know that this death has really, really rocked Pender County. Like I said, I get emails about it every single week. But we're moving at the state's pace right now, and like you said, investigations take time.
That's right. All right, well, we've talked a bit about southeastern North Carolina, but I want to zoom out for a moment and talk about kind of a different beat that you follow this year, the State House. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, man. So my focus is always going to be southeastern North Carolina, as that is my main beat, and it's what WHQR covers. It's where I live. But member stations throughout North Carolina often collaborate on more statewide coverage. So WUNC manages most of it, but stations like WFAE in Charlotte and WFDD in the Triad also step in from time to time to help. So in my case, I noticed an influx of bills relating to transgender rights and healthcare in North Carolina. A lot of these kind of flew under the radar, even though many of them would have a huge impact on transgender and cisgender North Carolinians. So that's why I started writing about them. Some of those bills ended up dying just as bills, but many of them passed and became law. House Bill 805, for instance, it was kind of like an anti-trans omnibus bill with provisions recognizing only two sexes and limiting healthcare for trans prisoners, among many other things. Democratic Governor Josh Stein vetoed that bill. It was overrode and then became law. Josh Stein also signed another anti-trans bill, which was the Parents Protection Act. That did away with a number of protections for transgender foster youth and adoptees and went into effect on July 1st. Reporting on those stories, it was hard for many reasons. I've never done State House reporting before, so there was definitely a learning curve there. I'd also be lying if I said it didn't have a great impact on me personally. I don't really talk about it on the air that much, but I myself am a transgender man, and many of my friends and loved ones are trans as well. So not to get too mushy, but I count myself lucky to have supportive colleagues like you who encourage me to follow these stories. I'm glad I was able to shed some light on the legislation.
Well, I have to say, you know, there's always a concern that your personal feelings will bias you on a story. I will say, as your editor, I was impressed at how even-handed you are at dealing with some of this legislation, even though it was, in my personal opinion, sometimes pretty hateful legislation. But no, you did a good job.
Thank you.
It was reporting that was falling through the cracks. Like, other people were not on this story. So I'm glad you were able to cover it.
Well, thanks for helping me with that. I really appreciate it.
Okay, let's talk about something less depressing.
Yes.
You did have some fun stories this year. We do have fun in the newsroom from time to time. Give me a quick rundown on some of your favorites.
I loved talking to John Waters. He's one of my idols, and he was absolutely hilarious. I'm glad that you were able to join me for that, too. It was just so funny being in that Zoom room.
Kind of
him.
Surreal.
So surreal. I'm like, dang, you sound like that in real life. That's crazy. Love that. I loved queening out with the author, Carmen Maria Machado. She is so brilliant, so fun, has written so many amazing books. I love chatting with the public radio all-star, David Sedaris, about his travels. I love talking to Dan Brawley from Kookaloris about David Lynch after he passed away in January last year. I don't know, talking to cool, smart people is one of the many perks to this job. I love doing that. Also, it's been nearly a full year since I published this story, but the Chalet Shuttle was an absolute delight to ride and report on. If you're near Shalote, give it a whirl one of these days. You won't regret it.
Just hearing the phrase Chalet Shuttle.
Chalet Shuttle.
Makes me kind of happy.
Named after an alligator. Or was it a crocodile?
An aquatic lizard. Either a crocodile or an alligator. We'll have to fact check that. But for now, Nikolai, thanks so much for your reporting this year, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Ben. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, that's just about all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to my colleagues Rachel Keith, Aaliyah McConnell, Kelly Kinoyer, and Nikolai Mather, and, of course, WHQR Program Director Ken Campbell. Music for today's show was provided by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions, and in just a moment, Girl School is going to play us out. If you have questions, comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show in the new year, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom, but until then, happy holidays and happy new year.